Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Hola, I'm Gustavo Arellano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times and host of the podcast The Times, daily news from the LA Times. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the middle of June and the second week of historic public hearings on Capitol Hill, detailing former President Trump's role in using the big lie to try to overturn the 2020 election. Let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. I'm your guest host, and you're left, even though I'm kind of a rancho libertarian. But as always, we have a center and a right and a special guest. On the right, I'm joined by Sarah Isger. She's the host of the legal podcast Advisory Opinions from The Dispatch, and she was a spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
From the center, we're joined by John Avlon, a senior political analyst and CNN anchor. He's also the author of the recent book, Lincoln and the Fight for Peace. Hello, John.
Hey, good to be with you.
And we're also joined by our special guest, Emily Bazelon. She's a staff writer at New York Times Magazine and co-host of Slate's Political Gabfest. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So the January 6th congressional hearings have centered on the role that President Trump played in instigating the riots over many weeks and failing to stop the violence once it started, even as his own vice president's life was in danger. I want to run through what ustedes think are some of the more important revelations, the most disturbing details, and a bit we'll talk about whether we think any of that is going to lead to indicting Trump. For me, some of the most damning evidence so far that I've heard includes, let's see, Trump was detached from reality in the days after the election, according to his former Attorney General Bill Barr. Team Normal exited, and Rudy's team, not the Notre Dame Fighting Irish Rudy, but rather Giuliani, they took over, according to campaign manager Bill Stepien, that Trump's own daughter, Ivanka Trump, thought her father's claim of election fraud were wrong, and that in reference to Attorney Barr's thoughts, quote, she accepted what he was saying. I mean, I already knew Trump was a sore loser, but all of this and everything that's coming out is just like more trash in his eternal dumpster fire of grievances. I'm here for the flames. But Emily, what have you been most gripped by?
I mean, I think you're right to highlight former Attorney General Bill Barr's testimony, because you can see here that Barr was just done, right? I mean, he comes in the middle of the Trump administration to basically save Trump from the Mueller report, really shapes how the public views that report before the entire report is released. And at this point, he becomes a kind of, you know, rule of law attorney general. He is not willing to entertain what he sees as a crazy scheme to overturn the election. And so he resigns. I mean, I think it's important that he didn't go public with any of his deep, it seems, questions about whether Trump was deluded at the time. But once he's under oath in front of this committee, he is being really caustic and dismissive about former President Trump and his mindset. And I think that that is really interesting, both in terms of public perception and also this question of whether Trump could be indicted.
Sarah, what are you paying attention to?
Everything Emily said is so true about former Attorney General Barr. Previously, we've been talking about January 6th, the violence at the Capitol, which I think is terrible. I condemn it at every sense of the term. But that's not the danger that our country was in that day. Our country was in danger in the run up to January 6th because of what was happening on January 6th, and that was the certification of the votes. Today is about the effort to persuade Mike Pence to ignore his constitutional role and instead prevent a transfer of power, peaceful or otherwise, and simply keep President Trump in office. From a legal standpoint, these are the conversations that I have been looking forward to. I will say I have one frustration, which is that on the one hand, you have this committee that is bipartisan in name only. Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger have been totally rejected by the Republican Party. And they also 100% accept the overall thesis of the January 6th committee. I wish we had more skeptical people on the committee, because I think that we are at our sort of best truth finding through a process of adversarial cross-examination. Even during the impeachment trials, we had that. And I thought that it was a better way for someone like me, who's a skeptic, who is a contrarian, to see the best arguments on the other side. We're not getting that. And that's a frustration for me.
John, what has been getting to you?
The fact that this is completely unprecedented in American history, and we can lose sight of that in the day-to-day news cycle, or the fact that we've been dealing with this for over a year and a half. There's just no precedent in American history for a U.S. president to try to overturn an election by trying to force his vice president to refuse to certify an election under pressure from an angry mob who he hoped could kill him. The legal arguments are bogus, but we can't get numb to just how historically awful and frankly evil in terms of its threat to our democratic republic this is. And I'll say, look, you know, every major incident in living memory that's known by a single date, 9/11, Pearl Harbor Day, November 22nd, JFK's assassination, has had a congressional investigation of some kind. It's been bipartisan because both parties understood that we needed to unite to get the facts, to learn the right lessons. And the Republicans, after initially calling for it and saying they'd support it, backed away or tried to put poison pill people on the panel, people who have so far refused subpoenas and allegedly asked for pardons from the president on the way out the door. So I think Kinzinger and Cheney have enormous credibility. And the fact that the vast majority of people who have testified before this committee are Republicans, telling a fairly consistent story, including people who are close up to Trump in the administration and in the campaign. The only people defending Donald Trump's lie at this point are people who refuse to testify under oath.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, going to Sarah's point, like, I understand you want people who are on the other side who are going to be a little bit skeptical of what's coming in front of them. Pero qué más quieres? Like, what else do you want? You're seeing this testimony. And we're not talking about people from the Democrats, from the left. We're talking about Bill Barr. We're talking about all these people who are saying, Trump was in a bad place. What was leading up to January 6th, it was in a bad place. But Sarah, at least, you know, what else would you have wanted to see besides, I guess, more Republicans? And also, do you think it's been effective storytelling, at least the committee that we do have, that they've been pushing the narrative that they think is going to be the one that's going to stand for the history books?
John's 100% right about how we got the committee we got. Republicans initially wanted folks like Jim Jordan. Nancy Pelosi says no and rejects the Republican list. And then Republicans take their ball and go home and refuse to put on people who, again, I don't want Jim Jordan, who's just going to make a hash of the whole thing. I want people who actually are going to try to probe, skeptical.
Like, who do you think would be good or would have been good?
Oh, I think there are plenty of Republicans. Chip Roy comes to mind as someone from Texas, for instance, who was very skeptical of what was going on. And he was the one who brought up the bill to say that if you want to reject the top of the ticket, then you have to reject all of the congressional results, including the ones where we got elected. And folks, of course, refused to vote for that either. So someone like that, who's a super Trump guy in some respects, but also thought that the election stuff was nonsense. That would be a person who I think could, I agree that on the one hand, you have this very Democratic committee, but on the other hand, you're hearing from Trump officials over and over again. I think that is the most effective way they could do this. I just wish we had people who could ask those follow-up questions that the people on the committee aren't even going to think of because they already agree with what's being said.
I mean, there's just so much grifting and all that. One of the things that also came up was, you know, what committee members called the big ripoff, this non-existent election defense fund that raised $250 million. Is that explicitly a campaign violation, Emily?
I think it certainly could be. It sort of depends on exactly how this group was registered, what the rules of PACs are, which have become kind of obscure and complicated. The question is whether there would ever really be a legal remedy. I mean, we have a really paralyzed Federal Election Commission at this point, and enforcement of campaign finance laws, especially when there's any kind of gray area, has really, really diminished.
John, your thoughts?
Yeah, look, it the scam pack aspect of this could end up being serious. There are statutes that have been discussed, including conspiracy to defraud the United States, that could apply. The DOJ has increasingly prosecuted scam packs, but Emily's 100% right. We have a deadlocked FEC by design at this point. What I think you cannot underestimate is this. The degree to which the partisan economy is itself corrupting, the way that so many figures only spoke out under oath because they were afraid that if they spoke out in real time to defend the Constitution and our democracy, that it might hurt their earning potential within the partisan economy ecosystem down the line. That itself should be a massive wake-up call. I think, you know, the question of what the DOJ will do, only the DOJ can answer. But laws exist for a reason. Laws need to be enforced for a reason. And there are, from conspiracy to defraud the United States to seditious conspiracy, there are laws on the books that would seem to apply to precisely this kind of action.
We talk about this ecosystem of conservatives going around. The committee also announced this week that they have emails that reveal that Virginia Ginni Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, was involved much more extensively in trying to overthrow the election than originally known. And we also learned that conservative lawyer John Eastman, who was a professor at my alma mater, Chapman University, go Panthers, proud alums out there, that he played a key role and was emailing with Ginni Thomas. Sarah, you mentioned right before we got on that Ginny's actually, she's ready to go and talk about her role in all this.
Correct. The Daily Caller just reported moments ago before we started taping that Ginni Thomas said, "I can't wait to clear up misconceptions. I look forward to talking to them," suggesting she would comply with the request to testify.
Well, what do you think she's going to tell them? Like, how are those fireworks going to go?
That is such an interesting question. I mean, she has been the focus of so much attention going back to January, you know, before even her text messages were revealed with then Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. There were profiles being written about Ginni Thomas, her role in the Republican conservative ecosystem, and her beliefs, whether it's January 6th or just other sort of far right beliefs as a Supreme Court justice's wife. You know, as I think, for women who work in this sphere and have husbands who also have jobs, it was interesting as that unfolded because I felt very torn about, for instance, if my husband had a high profile job like that, would I have to stop doing this podcast, for instance, because my opinions could be attributed to him? Obviously, he has very different opinions than me. But that's very different than I think what the committee wants to talk to her about, which will be the text messages to the White House, her conversations with John Eastman, and in particular, a email that John Eastman sent where he appears to say that he has inside information about what the Supreme Court is considering and whether there are votes to take any of these cases.
Another ecosystem person, Emily, what do you make of Liz Cheney's central role in all of this? We mentioned earlier, only her and Adam Kinzinger, they're the only other GOP members in this committee. They've been written off as rhinos. They have gotten so much just hate from the Republican Party, from conservative activists. What credibility do they both have at this point?
I mean, I think they have a lot of credibility with the country and very little credibility with Republicans who support former President Trump. I mean, I have to say, I find the social dynamic of imagining being Liz Cheney pretty fascinating because she has a really strong sense that what she's doing is right. And she's flying in the face of presumably many people she knows, all her political allies. It is really hard to stand up to your entire community and say, I'm about to do the thing you wish I would not do the very most. I am going to be that person. There's just some real spine there, whatever you think about the rest of her politics.
And then, John, really quickly, I know you once worked for Rudy Giuliani as a speechwriter. What do you make of the role he seemed to play on election night? I mean, I think the biggest takeaway the country got from him is that from the committee that he was supposedly inebriated and urging Trump to declare victory.
Yeah, that seems to be the case under testimony from both Bill Stepien and Jason Miller, who also worked for Rudy Giuliani during his ill-fated 2008 campaign. I think Rudy has descended into being a disgrace because he devoted his energies in this final chapter of his life to supporting conspiracy theories and trying to overturn our democracy. And I was proud to work for him when he was mayor. I thought he did a great job in turning around New York City. Nobody's perfect. and Rudy's the last person ever would be to try to claim he's perfect. But he did not have a drinking problem when I worked for him. And he also is someone who used to say to be locked into partisan politics doesn't permit you to think clearly. Well, he is not thinking clearly, and it's in part because he's locked into partisan politics. It's disgraceful to see.
This is what scares me the most, at least, about all these revelations. We knew what happened January 6th was horrible. The lead up into this was horrible. But who's doing all this horrible stuff? A cast of buffoons. This is who nearly brought down democracy in the United States. Just a bunch of fools, dummies, just whack jobs, for lack of a better word.
So much weirder, by the way, if you also open that up into what we now have from the Department of Justice, the Washington Post piece about the efforts to remove the acting attorney general and acting deputy attorney general. At one point, one of the lawyers turning to Jeff Clark in the Oval Office in front of Donald Trump after they said, this person is wildly unqualified, Mr. President. Jeff Clark pipes up and says, well, actually, I've run very complicated civil litigation and environmental law. And they said, great, then go back to your office and we'll call you when there's an oil spill. It's like the sickest legal burn I've ever heard.
That's a good cut. I mean, you know, but the fact that these folks who were huffing conspiracy theories of all stripes got directly in the president's ear and head, that he's passing, you know, he has access to all the intelligence services, the best in the world. And he chooses to believe people peddling self-serving conspiracy theories every time. And it does, among other things, mean we need to strengthen the guardrails around the presidency. It means we need to remember that character is the single most important quality in a president. And we need to learn the right lessons, including strengthening the Electoral Count Act, so this can't happen again. You know, the treating this as some kind of, you know, tragic comic farce does a real disservice to our democracy. It should be a damn wake up call.
It should be a damn wake up call. But comedy also sometimes just emboldens people to finally realize what the truth is. Hence, Mel Brooks. I'll be back with Sarah Isger, John Avlon, and Emily Bazelon to talk about whether any of this could end up in actual legal charges against Trump. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Gustavo Ariano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times, and your guest host, coming at you from the left. In the center is John Avlon, author of the recent book, Lincoln and the Fight for Peace. On the right is Sarah Isger, staff writer and podcast host at The Dispatch. Our special guest is Emily Bazelon, staff writer at The New York Times Magazine and co-host of Slate's Political Gabfest. One of the Americans who's tuning into the hearings is Attorney General Merrick Garland. He says he's been watching them very closely and claims he plans to hold any and all criminally responsible accountable. Sarah, you were a former spokesperson at the Justice Department under Trump. I'm curious, how strong of a case you think has the committee built so far? Like for the, specifically the criminal charges?
Not. So here's the problem.
Not.
We're looking at a couple specific statutes dealing with obstruction of official proceedings. Actually, many of the same things that the people who came into the Capitol have been charged with by the Department of Justice. A, you have some legal problems in the case already about what that statute really should apply to. We're talking about the President of the United States and whether he can even be charged with something like that. And even for the people around him who were relying, for instance, on legal counsel. John Eastman may be a buffoon of a lawyer, but he's still a lawyer at that point. And we often protect people who are relying on advice of counsel in terms of what they do. But set aside even the legal merits of it, the Department of Justice, really, it's an interesting question. Do you bring the cases that should be brought, or do you only bring the cases that you can win? And the Department of Justice has a long-standing internal policy of the latter, only bringing cases you believe you will win at trial. These are not cases that I think are slam dunks at all. Again, set aside even those legal problems. And so if it's a 50-50 coin flip for Garland, he would be walking away from a tradition at the Department of Justice to bring any of these cases.
On the other hand, you had U.S. District Court Judge David O. Carter in the ruling about the emails that John Eastman didn't want to turn over. He said in a ruling, quote, "It's more likely than not that President Trump corruptly attempted to obstruct the joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021. So, John, you were going to say something.
Accountability is the only language people understand at the end of the day. If there's not accountability, this coup attempt, which has been what has been called by members of the committee, will be just practice. Laws exist for a reason, but they are meaningless if they are not enforced. If trying to overturn an election by a sitting president of the United States is not wrong, what is, if you care about democracy? Seditious conspiracy, at the very least, would seem to fit, and members of the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys have been charged to date. A lot more information needs to come out, but here's what we do know. We do know that the president of the United States was told repeatedly that trying to overturn the election was both wrong and illegal. John Eastman was told that, including by the deputy counsel at the White House. Every step of the way, these folks were told, you cannot do this. It is illegal to try to overturn an election, including by the means you're suggesting. And while we are in uncharted territory definitionally, there is no tradition that applies here. It seems that the defense of our democracy is the highest obligation. And I'll read you one thing that I found, because this has been a bit of a hobby horse for me. Chief Justice William Howard Taft wrote a piece in 24 clarifying about what it means to the conspiracy to defraud the United States charge, which you're hearing increasingly invoked. And here's what he wrote. To conspire to defraud the United States means primarily to cheat the government out of property or money. But it also means to interfere with or obstruct one of its lawful governmental functions by deceit, craft, or trickery, or at least by means that are dishonest. Seems to me you just described the big lie.
Emily, your thoughts?
So I really like how John just said that our highest obligation is to defend our democracy. If you think that a crime was committed here, then yes, the Justice Department should prosecute, because arguably this is one of the highest, meaning worst, crimes a public official has ever committed, if indeed that's what happened, right? I mean, trying to prevent the peaceful transfer of power, that is what our democracy is about. On the other hand, if the Justice Department indicts former President Trump right now, the public is going to be hugely divided about it. We're going to have, instead of, you know, some prayer of some kind of conversation about political accountability, it's going to dissolve into, I fear, a lot of legal technical questions about what can be proven about Trump's state of mind, about whether it's proper to use these statutes in this particular way when we haven't used them that way before. And I have to say, I just sort of deeply resent the position that Trump has put the country in, where we have to choose between potentially not defending the democracy and charging a former president, which is something that usually happens in a banana republic.
Sarah, there's thousands, you know, there's hundreds of people up for charges, for their actions on January 6th. So out of the political realm, the people actually tried to storm the Capitol. If you think that there's probably not going to be any criminal charges against Trump, do you think Biden's administration is able to get anything by having all these other people charged and convicted for everything that they did on January 6th?
You mean win politically?
Yeah. I mean, because at the end, it's all politics. So what do you think?
So right now, let me give both sides of this argument. On the one hand, really high viewership on that initial night of this hearing, 21 million people, higher than either impeachment. So that's a lot of people. Do I think any of those 21 million people hadn't already made up their minds about what they were about to see? No. Also, Fox News wasn't even showing it. So we can basically already say, no, those people already knew what they were tuning into. At the same time, we look at Google searches, social media, and January 6th is a very low interest topic compared to even the Depp Heard trial, for instance. And look, Democrats, I think, have a win here. It's not an electoral win, but in the last month, Democratic campaign committees have sent out 500 emails fundraising off of this. And so for that very small number of small dollar donors in the country, about 2% of registered voters will ever give money, and they are not representative of voters at large. They are more turned on by outrage and anger. We've seen that on the right. We've seen it on the left. I think it's a huge problem in our politics right now. But those are the people who Democrats are turning on at the moment. They are raising money off of that. And that will be very helpful heading into November.
Do you think this is, though, a campaign issue that's going to have more legitimacy for the Democrats come November than, say, what's going to happen with Roe versus Wade?
Well, I don't know how you calculate that hierarchy, right? I mean, if Roe v. Wade is overturned at, you know, the end of June, I think that will wake a lot of people up. to the impact of the Supreme Court on their lives, because for the first time in memory, a right is being taken away. And after a lot of assurances by many conservatives that that stare decisis and this would never be removed, I think that will activate people in a very different way. Now, how that lies up against, you know, frustrations about prices at the pump and inflation. Well, one thing is those pains are very real. People vote on the economy, but those pains are transitory. This is a lasting legacy. So too is defending our democracy. And I think, you know, we constantly run the risk of amusing ourselves to death. I was looking at during a Watergate, inflation was 11.4%. So to some extent, all this is relative. But again, there's just no precedent for an American president trying to overturn an election and then a political party to rally around what is now self-evidently a lie. And I think Sarah and her colleagues, the Dispatch and their compatriots and competitors at the Bulwark, do represent a minority position inside the Republican Party, but one that will continue to grow as Republicans see their fellow Republicans and people who served Donald Trump say very clearly, the president was delusional. He lost the election fair and square. He knew he was lying and he tried to destroy our democracy anyway to hold on to power and preserve his ego.
Emily, it's true. This is something that has never happened. Our democracy was under attack. Yet more people cared about Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. More people probably care about maybe just on the East Coast and West Coast, Boston Celtics versus Golden State Warriors in the NBA Finals. How on earth can the Democrats make people actually care and realize how important what they're doing is?
I think Democrats need to look at the issues that really resonate with people. And they are not necessarily election interference, however much I might want that to be the most important issue, nonpartisan issue for everyone in the country. They are more likely to be things like protecting Social Security and bringing down gas prices and the rest of inflation. And yes, I think attention to abortion this fall has the potential to, maybe be different in the past when abortion has really been an issue that has galvanized conservatives. Maybe that will change. But I think Democrats need to be realistic about what resonates broadly. And, people don't necessarily think of defending the democracy as the first thing when they wake up in the morning. Yeah. It can seem abstract. We can all get a little complacent. Is it really being threatened? And, then of course we also have a right-wing media ecosphere in which these issues just don't get traction because they're not being aired and discussed in the same way.
And you also have other politicians, that the Department of Justice is looking into that took part in the rally on January 6th. And so far, only a handful of them have faced legal consequences, while a majority of them are actually running for office. I'm thinking Doug Mastriano in Pennsylvania, Mark Fincham in Arizona. So Emily, what do you think that your reaction would be if the Department of Justice, beyond Trump and beyond his inner circle, starts holding accountable, legally or otherwise, some of these other politicians who did take part in January 6th?
I mean, it's a really interesting question. Outside of the Republican Party, presumably it's not going to be helpful. But among, the base, in terms of rallying the base, I think many of these politicians have been really successful at casting themselves as victims, essentially, of, the quote, deep state. And I'm not sure in a deeply contested election. I mean, you mentioned the Pennsylvania governor's races. The polls this week have been very close. That is a state already with a Republican-controlled legislature. It's a purple state, but if Pennsylvanians elect Republican Doug Mastriano as governor, you could see some serious policy shifts there, including banning abortion.
John, you recently wrote a book about looking at President Lincoln's leadership after the nation was torn by civil war. Obviously, we're not in civil war right now, but any signs that the country can be on the mend from the Trump years? And also these hearings, are they a salve on that wound?
Yes, potentially, because this is about asserting the rule of law across partisan lines and reinforcing the thing that there is such a thing as truth and fact, even if it requires people to be under oath to do it. Studying the Civil War is helpful in a number of different ways, one of which is it provides perspective on our problems. We've been through worse. We got through it. And we'll get through this as well. But, Lincoln is our greatest president, but he's bookended by two of our worst, James Buchanan and Andrew Johnson. And it does require leadership, not only at a presidential level, but on a citizenry level and certainly in Congress, for people to try to aspire to the better angels of our nature. And at the very least, that means insisting that there is such a thing as truth and it matters. that defending our democracy matters more than playing to the political base. The problem is that our politics have become so structurally fragmented that everyone's just looking at how you can win a close partisan primary, and they're willing to play to the base by embracing the big lie to do that. And there's a whole hyperpartisan, you know, economy and ecosystem that reinforces that. And the question of whether it reflects the truth or a opinion of a super majority of voters doesn't seem to be top of mind, because we don't have enough competitive general elections, particularly in Congress. So we need to take this as an opportunity to majorly reset as a nation, to remember the difference between right and wrong, truth and lies, and to begin trying to heal the breach in our politics and the structural issues that has enabled this to occur.
Sarah, does any side want that though?
I hope so. I mean, that's why we're here. Truly, you know, I think that John is exactly right. We're in this moment. We're looking back through our history to think about other moments that have been existential. And there are more than even just the Civil War. You know, there's a reason that we've been talking about the Electoral Count Act today during this hearing. The Electoral Count Act came after the election of 1876, when we did not have a clear winner. And there were absolutely claims of election fraud. And it was a compromise even to pick a president at that point. The problems that we have are fixable. The moment and the incentives that we have in our politics are dangerous. And I really like what Alaska is doing. They just had their first election under their new rules, a nonpartisan primary where everyone runs together, as we saw in that one congressional race. Santa Claus ran against Sarah Palin, literally, all the same. The top four finishers of that will go on to the general election in November, and that will be done by ranked choice voting, so that the person who has the most support from all voters will move forward. Not only will it change who will run, it'll change who will win, and it will change what their incentives are once they're in office.
Emily, can these hearings help offer a reset for this politics that we're at now?
They are super necessary. I don't think they're going to reset our politics, but we have to do them anyway for history's sake.
That's exactly the best way to do it. I've been talking with Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times and co-host of Political Gabfest. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with Sarah Isger and John Avlon to talk about the Fed and inflation. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your guest host and left, Gustavo Ariano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times. On the right is Sarah Isger, staff writer at the Dispatch. From the center, we're joined by John Avlon, author of the recent book, Lincoln and the Fight for Peace. The Federal Reserve did something it hasn't done in decades. It raised interest rates by 0.75 points, the biggest hike since 1994 when I was a freshman in high school. But is it enough to fight inflation? John, for non-economists like me, who all I know about money is I stuff it in a tomato can, what's a move like that supposed to do?
A tomato can. First thing you should know is not put your money in tomato can.
I'm old school.
This move is designed. You raise interest rates to try to tame inflation. We have existed in a blissful period since the mid 1980s, where inflation has not been much of a concern. We had low interest rates and people took them for granted. The way we got inflation, which was out of control in the 1970s in particular, under control, was we had a chairman of the Fed named Paul Volcker, appointed by Carter initially, reappointed by Reagan, who raised interest rates dramatically, pushing the country into a mini recession, but finally got inflation under control. Inflation is a majorly destabilizing force. It is a thief of people's paychecks. We are experiencing that now at not historic levels, but historic in recent memory levels. And so what they did, Powell, the Fed did, is necessary. The question is, what took them so long? You know, we had a 50 basis point raise a little while ago, now a 0.75. That's great. It'll help. But it would have helped a lot more if they'd gotten to this party earlier. And they were caught flat-footed. And a lot of folks are paying the price literally at the pump and elsewhere.
What took them so long, you think?
I think that the economy's recovery from COVID has been herky-jerky. And look, people need to understand that, you know, we're not living through bad economic times right now. We're living through high gas prices, high inflation, for sure. But one of the most robust job markets in recent memory. We've got 3.6% unemployment. Consumer spending is high. So we're in a schizophrenic moment economically. It is not all bad news at all. It's just that inflation is eating into the gains people are making. Why did they wait so long? I think they were concerned that if they raised rates too soon, too far, too fast, it would take the recovery from COVID, which has contributed to all the issues we're dealing with, especially supply chain issues, which also impact inflation, and hurt the recovery. And they frankly were not thinking far enough ahead.
And now they're trying to play catch up. Fed Chair Jerome Powell admitted that acting this fast might actually increase unemployment. Sarah, thoughts on whether all of this is going to be worth it?
Well, we talked earlier about whether January 6th or even abortion, if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade in the next 2 weeks, would have an effect in November. There's various data we can look to for that. And a lot of it suggests that even right now, that wouldn't really affect anything. But the truth is, any issue will pale in comparison to what we are talking about right now, because what the Fed is doing will have a big effect on what happens next. We hope that it is getting inflation under control. For all the reasons that John just said, I think it's a smart thing to do at this point. I think it was actually smart that they waited, as frustrating as that is. You don't want to do something this drastic when you are coming off of a worldwide pandemic, supply chain issues that might resolve themselves. You do want to give that a minute and see what the actual effects when that all settles down will be. Unfortunately, when you have the war in Ukraine, the supply chain issues not actually setting themselves back immediately, and a labor market that is almost too good, unfortunately. This was, I think, the right move now. But as you say, it could have all sorts of other ripple effects in the economy. It will cool down that job market as a way of also getting inflation under control. It will absolutely affect the housing market. We've seen a housing market that, again, is too hot. Housing prices going up incredibly quickly. People interested in selling their houses, making a killing. But of course, then you still have to live somewhere. By raising this, you know, we'll see changes in car buying, changes in house buying, and changes in savings, right? So the loan issue is going to have a huge impact on that housing market. We saw in 2008 what happens when something goes wrong in the housing market. That's the thing you want to watch for and hope that we get inflation under control by doing this and not trigger a recession.
Let me just add something as the centrist here too. It's just a reminder of how essential the right equilibrium is in our politics and our economy, the habitable zone in terms of life and the environment, the Goldilocks theory. You know, when people try to manipulate things and take things too, you know, already hot economy for political purposes, it ends badly ultimately. The laws of gravity apply. And so it is about finding this right balance. And we're out of balance right now for a variety of reasons. By the way, Britain's got 11% inflation rate right now. So it's not just here in the United States, as Sarah said.
Yeah, I was going to say, with the housing market, it's out of control all over the place. So do you actually think by raising those interest rates, it actually might become a silver lining to make living more affordable?
That's harder to see. The answer ultimately for the housing problems in the United States is to build more housing. You know, we need to increase supply and start spending more money and effort reviving regional economies again, you know, that have great housing stock in areas that were once well populated and have become less so as jobs have concentrated in a handful of regional markets. Those are macroeconomic challenges that require like real industrial policy. But you ultimately need to build more housing.
Sarah, given that inflation was caused mostly by things out of Joe Biden's control, like the pandemic, Russia's war on Ukraine, is he being unfairly blamed for inflation? Has he failed to message how he helped save the economy and that this is just an unfortunate side effect of all the wonderful things he was doing?
Part of the blame on Joe Biden is absolutely unfair, but we do this with every president, right? They take credit for all of the good things. And so then when bad things happen, we give them credit for all of the bad things too. Joe Biden cannot wave a magic wand and reset the economy right now. At the same time, I think the White House has made big mistakes policy-wise in trying to spend more and more money, thinking that it would never contribute to inflation. Remember, they were asked about this a year ago and said, no, no, inflation will be transitory. They were wrong. His Treasury Secretary now coming out and saying that she was just mistaken about that. Well, that's a pretty big oops. Second, I think they've made a mistake by blaming rising gas prices on the war in Ukraine. Absolutely, there is some number of cents on the dollar that we're paying right now that is being caused by that. But gas prices were rising far before anything over there was happening. And I think it makes the White House look out of touch to simply say this is Putin's gas hike when Americans know that that's not the case. And lastly, again, I think you look at something like the baby formula shortage. I know that's not directly tied to inflation, but where the White House seems to just be unaware of what's happening in most Americans' lives, that when they go to the grocery store, that food is up 11.9% versus restaurants, which is a little bit lower. And then gas prices out of control. And then baby formula is not there. I think there is a sense that there is chaos and doom, and the White House has failed to speak to the American experience in that sense. But is it all on his feet that like Joe Biden caused this moment? No.
Yeah, I mean, this goes, I mean, with gas prices have doubled ever since the war in Ukraine, basically in this year. So they were increasing a little bit, but nowhere near what happened with this global chaos going on with Ukraine and all of that.
But let me push back on that a little. Gas prices were on the rise. They were going to continue to rise.
Oh, yeah, they were on the rise, but not doubling. Not even close to doubling.
To simply say that, therefore, everything that happened post-Ukraine is caused by Ukraine. Well, no, because some percentage of that was going to continue to rise regardless.
John.
No, but it's also OPEC and MBS not increasing production. That's a major factor, and there may or may not be a political lens to that. And that's one of the reasons why the president's going to Saudi Arabia and probably reversing a lot of his campaign pledges in the process. These are geopolitical problems that really, as Sarah, I think, fairly said, are not all on the administration. But what I think does demand a little bit more accountability in particular is that we just went through a period where people thought they could spend and as much money as they wanted without any negative impact. I mean, I want to hear from, you know, folks, the MMT believers on the left, who just said, you know, oh, inflation's not a thing. You can spend money endlessly and deficit and debts don't matter. I would like to hear a little bit of accountability because that, you know, the this time it's different crowd doesn't seem to have been right.
Not just accountability, but also reality. I mean, now people are asking,
yes,
is a recession now unavoidable? Talk to the people on the ground who are seeing this. Like I always say this, my wife has a restaurant. We've seen business go down because people are not spending as much anymore because of gas prices, because of inflation. And yet I saw on Twitter, one of the MSNBC hosts whose name escapes me right now, he's kind of mocking the idea that he talked to a restaurant owner and the restaurant owner himself was saying like, yeah, we're in a recession. He's like, oh no, you're not. You know, you do not know what exactly is happening. So I think especially with the Democrats, and you were talking about earlier that, yeah, a year ago, they were dismissing the idea of an inflation, even as the rest of us on the ground knew what was coming. We could see what was coming. But again, it wasn't all just based on what Biden's actions were, but also what had happened with the economy, with COVID, and just all the chaos that's going all around us all the time. Sarah, is a recession then now unavoidable?
I certainly hope not. And I think that some of this will still be under the White House's control. Stop pushing the, you know, huge spending on the Hill. I think we should be thankful to Joe Manchin, frankly, for putting the brakes on some of those bills earlier on. Think how absolutely catastrophic that would be right now if we had all this money being pumped into an overheated economy. I think what the Fed is doing has the ability to have some effect, as I said, but certainly we have all the ingredients for a recession.
There are positive aspects to this economy right now, and there are a lot
what
of countervailing
are
winds. Right hot job market at the current moment and has been for quite a long time. Consumer spending is actually quite high, but it's facing now, you're starting to see the inflationary pressures. Some question about whether inflation will start to tack down as supply chains open up. But the war in Ukraine's not going to end anytime soon. And so those knock-on effects will continue to be felt. I will say, there are things that government can do that would help people. I mean, for example, reinstating the child tax credit would help a lot of families feeling a lot of additional pressure right now. And you know, a lot of these things can only be done with Congress, which has the power of the purse strings. But I think that the president and the administration need to think a little bit more creatively how to reduce pressure. And I do think there's still precious little, but some time for some kind of a deal. And it'll be modest. And it may be, you know, Manchin has talked about 50-50 deficit reduction and some kind of climate energy plan. But no time like the present. But some people's pressure on their pocketbook could be relieved, in particular with things like a child tax credit.
To each of you, how do you feel? How do you think each party's feeling about all of this right now? Primaries are just wrapping up. The general election is just months away. Sarah.
Obviously, Republicans feel like they have the wind in their backs. It'd be very hard to imagine a scenario where Republicans don't take back the House. Even the Senate, which is not a good map for Republicans at this point. Most of the open seats are Republican held, many of their incumbents up in competitive races. You know, two or three Democrats are even possible to knock off. But in this type of election, with this type of economy and Joe Biden's approval ratings where they are, Republicans starting to feel pretty bullish about the Senate. There are a couple more primaries that I'm interested in seeing the outcome of, particularly Missouri and Arizona, where you could see Republicans go perhaps a direction that wouldn't help them. Even Mitch McConnell has said that the former governor winning the Missouri primary, Greitens, could cost them a seat in Missouri. Very hard if Republicans start giving away seats for them to take back the Senate.
John.
And right now, Greitens looks likely. Look, there's a pendulum swing effect in the midterms that's almost inevitable. And certainly, if you look at the Democrats' House margin right now, and a lot of unforced errors they're making. Yeah, I wouldn't put a lot of money on the Senate right now in either direction. I think the House looks likely to go Republican, but there are going to be a lot of factors from defending. I think you're going to see much higher midterm turnout on both sides than you typically do. And there are going to be a lot of wins that are be people's backs from sort of angry mom frustration about gun violence and crime and reversing Roe v. Wade to the inflation and the economy to the natural sort of pendulum swing nature of midterm elections. So, you know, fasten your seatbelts.
Yeah, worth just a second on the two things that actually change outcomes in elections are turnout, someone getting someone to vote who was going to stay home, and someone changing their vote. We had record high turnout in 2018. And so the question you have to ask yourself about any of these issues is who didn't turn out in 2018, who would come out this time, or who would change their vote? And when you think about guns or abortion, two issues where the culture war has already really sorted people into their camps. And we have a lot of data to show that it is not moving voters from one to another. And with that record high turnout, again, it looks like the economy will really be driving this election.
Yeah, and so far in 2022, the turnout has been abysmal, so we'll see what ends up getting people out in November. We're gonna have to leave it right there. And we've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants, featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Sarah Isger, what's on your mind?
Lynn Wood, one of the attorneys who was working with Donald Trump to try to overturn the election, has come out to say that he has entered the flat earth debate. This is a debate that you may not even know was going on, but it, I guess, turns out that it's there. My last memory of the flat earth debate was in 2020, a lead flat earther actually died trying to prove that the earth was flat on a homemade rocket that he took up to try to get the vantage point to see. Flat eartherism can lead you down a fascinating YouTube rabbit hole, but I have to say, I guess I'm pleased that those folks are going to move into the flat earth debate, maybe leave the election integrity to those of us who have experience in this.
John Avlon, your rant better be about reptilians.
First of all, I appreciate the Flat Earth Society. Shout out to someone who wrote a book called Wingnuts once, and Kelly Wild just wrote a great book on the flat earthers. So I'm down with that. I'll riff off that. The problem in our politics is that the crazies have consistently hijacked our debates, and they've done it in part because it turns out that there's a lot of money to be made by peddling conspiracy theories and trying to appeal to the outer reaches of politics to the point that it starts bleeding in with the base and impacting even the U.S. Senate and Congress itself. And that's what we're reaping what we've sowed on that front. So, you know, the 50 years after Watergate, the Watergate burglary, it's always good to remember to follow the money and look at the structural incentives, including money, that cause people to abandon their principles on a dime and put party over country. That's what we need to stop. We need to reverse and start standing for principles over party again.
For my rant, this week marks 10 years since the creation of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, better known as DACA. It's a federal policy that allowed people who came to this country illegally before age 16 and met other requirements to be able to work legally and be protected from deportation. Over 800,000 people took advantage of DACA. I've known many of the recipients. They're all successful, incredible, wonderful people, but they're frustrated because DACA is like the Greek myth of Sisyphus, pushing a rock up a hill that inevitably rolls down. DACA remains the only real successful measure to rectify the status of undocumented people in this country over the past generation, and that Republicans don't want to extend full citizenship to people who weren't born in this country yet know no other country shows their inherent cruelty, and that Democrats haven't been able to pass an amnesty since President Reagan signed one in 1986 shows how inept they are on the subject. To all DACA recipients, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you've lived in limbo for a decade, and that you've lived in limbo for a decade proves that you're some of the best Americans we have. I just wish the people who ran this country felt the same. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to Sarah Isger, John Avalon, and Emily Bazelon. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Singer Schiff. The show is recorded and mixed by Matt Schwartz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Gustavo Arellano. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center. Gracias.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.